Okay, that was fun. So, like I said, I see some familiar faces, and it's nice to see all of you again. As June mentioned, I'm Megan Reeves. I'm the Assistant Director for Investigator Development with the WVCTSI, and we have Emily Morgan and Wes Kimball as well to help present. So I'm going to give a very brief overview of the CTSI. For those of you who may not be familiar, we were funded in 2012 by the National Institute of Health with a couple of big overarching objectives: to build sustainable research in the state, to recruit and train the next generation of clinical and translational scientists, and to engage with multiple stakeholders, so not just at WVU, but across the state with Marshall, Charleston Area Medical Center, the West Virginia School of Osteopathic Medicine. We've also partnered with the VA and NIOSH and with other community partners. So some of our cross-cutting themes, and the third one will be of most interest, I think, to this audience, is to first kind of support the endangered clinician scientists. So this is the idea that clinicians, you know, spend a lot of time in training and then graduate and find positions as faculty, and they really just don't have the time to do research that they may have been previously interested in. And so we want to help to protect some of their time and give them the tools in order to be successful as a clinician scientist. Our second cross-cutting theme is to, whenever possible, to do research or help research in rural and underserved communities. So West Virginia is a very rural state and the only state in the United States that's completely in the Appalachian region. And then our third cross-cutting theme is commercialization. And so we realize that, you know, the traditional R01 funding mechanism isn't going to be for everyone. And there's definitely opportunities and ways to move research and move translation forward via commercialization. And so that's one of our cross-cutting themes. And whenever we can, we like to support projects with that in mind. So ways that we do this, you know, we've got funding and services. We like to collaborate and train and recruit and work with our community partners. And so we've got almost 50 employees now with the WVCTSI that are full-time to help support research. Like I said, not just in WVU, but across the state, but pretty much all of the staff are located in Morgantown at the Health Sciences Center. So we've got 8 cores to help us accomplish these goals. And so they're listed up there. I won't read them all to you, but the ones that will probably be of most interest are our pilot project program, professional development, clinical research resources and facilities, and laboratory technologies. I mentioned before, we are a statewide organization, and so you can see all of our partners. And then on the map over here, all of these dots are individual members of our practice-based research network. And so the West Virginia Practice-Based Research Network was established and created with the WVCTSI. And it is the only practice-based research network in the state. And it's an opportunity for researchers to collaborate or partner with rural community healthcare settings on research or projects. The WVCTSI, you know, realizes that there are lots of things that we could help support research-wise and health priority-wise, but we targeted on what we thought the strengths were in our state or the needs of our state. And so the first one is addiction resulting emerging epidemic. So, you know, we've seen that, you know, for a while, hepatitis C and even HIV were resultant of addiction. The other emerging epidemic that we're all aware of right now and living is the global pandemic of COVID-19. So we've had quite a few different opportunities and things result related to COVID-19 research. Cancer, cardiovascular disease, chronic lung disease, neuroscience, including stroke and Alzheimer's. This is not to say that we don't support research outside of these areas, and almost pretty much any biomedical research in one way could be tied to one of these 5 overarching themes, but these are the things that we prioritize whenever possible. So I'll now kind of talk about some of the specific opportunities and services available through the CTSI. The first one is under our professional development umbrella. Man, technical difficulties today. So these may not be for all of you, but we do have a certificate, master's, and PhD program that students can go through in clinical and translational science. And so you may be interested in hosting a PhD student in your lab. They're come from a wide variety of backgrounds, and several of them have actually already gone through med school and are looking to get additional training in research. And so they get to do projects that have both a sort of bench side and a population side and a clinical side to their research. So when they go through, they're pretty well-rounded. We also have a Master's of Science program, and this is really targeted towards physicians, clinicians, people who, you know, are doing clinical or translational research but need additional training. And so it's set up to be online and can be completed with 2 years with your faculty tuition waivers. And instead of doing like a thesis at the end, you actually write a grant proposal, and that can be whatever type of grant proposal would be of most interest to you. So it may be interesting to you, or it may be something that you have an undergraduate or a graduate student in your lab already, and you want to let them know about these opportunities. A couple other things that we've got going on is our Research Scholars Program. So if you're familiar with the NIH Career Development Award, this is our internal mechanism, the Research Scholar Program. And so this is a competitive funding opportunity that will grant faculty members protected time plus a research budget. And so for people who have a high teaching load or a high clinical load, we will actually buy out a portion of their contracts so they have protected time to do research. And so this has been around for the past 9 years and will continue to be a part of our missions. If you find yourself interested in that, you can let me know and I can give you more information about that. Our Females Advancing Clinical and Translational Science, or FACTS program, is a professional development and networking group that meets about once a month. It's not limited to women, although a lot of times what we talk about are female-specific problems or opportunities. And this is a free opportunity. You don't need to be nominated. You can come and join events as they meet your availability. And then we have a lot of workshops and seminars that we put on each year that are, you know, anything from writing a grant proposal and specific aims tweaking to how to manage a lab and how to deal with difficult employees. Proposal development. So we have a director of proposal development in Joan Lukoski, and she has really developed a robust program and opportunities for those of you who are writing specifically NIH grants. And so she's got a K Award grant writing group, an R Series grant writing group, and then she does some consulting and coaching as well. And so if you're targeting an NIH deadline, you know, there are opportunities 3 times a year, and she will have grant writing clubs for each of those deadlines. And so you can participate in small groups. She really spends a lot of time walking through every section of the application and provides feedback. And we've had a lot of success with people getting improved scores and then resubmitting and getting awarded. So this is something that, like I said, is available every NIH cycle, with them starting up a couple months before the deadline. Pilot program. So we have 4 funding opportunities available each year. Our launch program is specifically targeted on projects that focus on commercialization and technology development. So we collected LOIs in August of this year, and we'll have full applications due in October. We're going up for CTSI renewal of funding for our entire organization. So I'm not sure when we'll have another launch opportunity, but if we get a good score, we'll certainly open up funding early and provide opportunities for those who are interested in this. And if you've got a pilot project that you'd like to discuss, you can reach out to me and we'll talk about what opportunities exist and hopefully make you competitive for some internal funding. Most of these are $50,000 awards. So sort of the last thing that I am going to talk to you guys a lot about is our Clinical Trials Center of Excellence. So this was established about a year ago and is really focused on providing the infrastructure for clinical trial research. And so if you've got a product, you know, a new drug or some type of technology, am I lost again? Can you guys hear me, or am I lost?
We can still hear you and see you.
Okay, sorry, I got a message. I thought I had a chat that said.
I think that was from before. You're good.
Okay. So let me just jump ahead again. So like I said, if you've got a drug or a piece of technology and you're not familiar with clinical trial research, but you need to do some pilot data or some testing in human subjects, we've got the infrastructure to help that be successful and to make sure that, you know, you're not doing something that will get you in trouble. We have people that are familiar with getting INDs or IDEs, so investigational new drug approval from the FDA, or investigational device exemptions from the FDA. And so we've got a team of people that can help you develop those protocols and submit them to the FDA and walk you through that process. They'll also make sure that, you know, if the FDA showed up to audit your study, that you're prepared, that you've got all the right documentation, and that you're completing the study in such a way that is not only scientifically sound, but also, you know, from a regulatory standpoint, that you have all your I's dotted and T's crossed. And so we hope this will improve efficiency. So those were the three goals of the Clinical Trials Center of Excellence. And so, you know, for projects that are outside of one of these, you'll see at the bottom, there's the CTSI, Cancer, Heart and Vascular Institute, Rockefeller Neuroscience Institute, PEDS, and there's some other clinical trial groups. But we work with all of them and provide training, internal audit quality. There's Encore, which is it's a trial management system that will actually be required starting in November for anybody doing a clinical trial. And it's really a great system that allows people to make sure that everybody on the study team has access to all the regulatory documents, all of the patient participant information, and just sort of centralizes the clinical trial management. So that's a provided service as well. And then there's a list of optional services, everything from IRB submission help, recruitment services, communication with the IRB. And a lot of this could be free if you've got a CTSI-sponsored study, or if you've got some pilot grant funding from somewhere else or some external funding, you can take advantage of that. So I think Hamed just asked if we have to pay for those services. So it kind of depends on whether your study is funded or not. But some of these are free services, and some of them, you know, if you were going to have a study coordinator, if it had external funding, you would need to pay for that. If there's no funding, that would be sort of, we would look at the type of project it is, look at the priority, health priority of it, and look at what resources we have available, but we wouldn't necessarily turn you away. But as you can imagine, we have sort of limited resources, and so we have to maybe be creative about what we could provide depending on the breadth of the study, the involvement of it. But certainly don't let that scare you away if you don't have funding to come to us to figure out what we might be able to do. So this kind of goes over each of the benefits. So I think I mentioned some of these. Encore will soon be required, so we'll help support that. There's clinicaltrials.gov support. So we actually had a speaker come and talk about the importance of clinicaltrials.gov reporting and compliance. So there can be major fees associated with the university if we're not reporting appropriately on clinicaltrials.gov. So if your study is sponsored externally, most likely you need to report on clinicaltrials.gov. And if it's an investigator-initiated study, that requirement is really on you. And so we can help you make sure that you're successful in getting it linked on the website and then doing all the follow-up and reporting as necessary. There's lots of standardized templates. You know, they worked with our team to make sure that we have electronic consent available. There's many templates to make sure that, you know, if you're giving participant gift cards or paying for them or informed consent, you know, all of that, we've got some standardized templates that would make you starting a study a lot easier. I mentioned earlier, which I think is important for this group, is the IND and IDE support. So if you've got a new drug or a new device, let us know and we can help you get that approved by the FDA. The PI Academy is a totally free resource that's part of the COE. and the WVCTSI. And so this is really like a learning opportunity and a training opportunity. And so there are things like our idea lab, where if you've got a new study in mind and want to sort of vet it with our team of experts, you can come and present, and they'll give you feedback on the spot on how to improve your study design or study execution. And so those are held the first Wednesday of every month. We have a certificate that you can earn in the PI Academy via SOL. It's free and self-paced. Actually, Constance Weiner, I see her on the call right now, and she was one of our first people to complete the certificate. And then when we get back to life as normal, we'll have quarterly dinners with invited speakers. Right now during the pandemic, we've really moved them to a webinar format. And this is really just to help provide the infrastructure and network of investigators doing clinical trials to let them know what's available, what the changing landscape is, whether it's federally or locally. Regulations change consistently, and so we want to make sure that people are up to date on everything that's happening. So one of the last things I'll talk about before I turn it over to Wes and Emily is Project Echo. And this may not be super relevant to a lot of you, but I'd be remiss if I didn't mention it. And so Project Echo is an opportunity similar to telemedicine, but it's really an opportunity for specialists either at WVU or Marshall or across the state to connect with primary care physicians or other care providers throughout the state to discuss specialty treatments, to talk about referrals or do case studies and didactics, and then to sort of have a two-way street where people can find out new information. And so for our specialists, they learn about what's really going on in the community, and for our community to learn about the latest breakthroughs, whether it's drugs or treatments and best practices. So we've got that going on. And I think, you know, you can see on the left-hand side all of the different topics that are covered. And so we've got sessions on hepatitis C and HIV, chronic pain, medication-assisted treatment, psychiatry, chronic lung disease, endocrine, cardiac health, COVID-19. We started in March as a response to the pandemic. And in the future, we're going to have one focused on memory and Alzheimer's. So with that, I'll turn it over to Wes or Emily. I'm not sure who's going to pick up now, but are there any questions I can answer thus far, or we can save them towards the end? Okay, none? Wes, are you picking up here, or is Emily?
Yep, I'm picking up here. Hi, everybody. This is Wes. And yes, I am sitting in my bed right now because I've got children all over my house taking online school classes. So that's the only place I could find any quiet time. Megan, are you going to handle the slides from here, or did you want me to switch them over?
I can handle it if you like.
Okay, cool. So like I said, I'm Wes Kimball. I'm the Assistant Director for Clinical Research Services at the WVCTSI. And that sort of entails a few different cores that I work with. Mainly, I'm involved with everything clinical data related, but I am in some other cores, such as the technology and resources core, or the tech core, as we call it. And there are many different resources available for investigators, such as the inhalation lab, which Dr. Tim Nurkowitz sort of manages. It's a very, very state-of-the-art, very large inhalation lab that, excuse me, it's actually large enough to do human trials in, although we've not done anything like that, nor probably would we ever, but it is one of the largest inhalation facilities in the country. We have a genomic shared facility that we have here at WVU, and then we also partner with Don Primorano at Marshall. They have a very robust genome sequencing service down there. We have multiple state-of-the-art imaging services such as MRIs, EPR, which is an electronic paramagnetic resonance imaging machine, similar to MRI, but very different in the ways, such as the amount of magnetic field it uses, things like that. We look at things clinically, such as delivering more oxygen to tumors to enhance treatment outcomes for cancer patients. We have microscope and animal imaging. flow cytometry, single cell analysis, and the EPR, which I just sort of talked about. Any questions about any of those things? I know I'm sure some of you have heard some of those, but maybe not everyone has heard all of them. So also in the tech core, we have a biospecimen repository. So we have a tissue bank, and that is run out of the pathology department. And we collect solid tissues. We can do prospectively, you know, for a prospective clinical trial per the protocol, or we also have stored tissue samples that are banked that folks can access. Right before COVID hit, we had actually put a lot of time into developing an online database that anybody could search that's de-identified to sort of see what disease sort of tumors we had available, you know, a lot of different clinical findings on those samples, so that folks could just log in, see does the tissue bank actually have what they need currently, you know, so that is available. We just never got to really push it out and make a big communication splash like we wanted to. But if anybody's interested in that afterwards, you can let Emily or myself know, and we can give you access. The tissue bank will also do the sample processing and preparation for you. So depending on how you want your samples, do you want them, you know, fresh, frozen, preserved? Do you want paraffin blocks? Do you want the block sliced? You know, it's kind of up to the investigator, but they can handle all those needs. And that's sort of part of the specimen processing piece. And if you're doing a prospective trial, you know, they can actually show up at the operating room to collect part of the specimen from the patient that's been consented for you and just bring it right back to either your lab or to the tissue bank to do the preparation for the samples as however you require for your protocol. Go ahead, Megan.
Anything on biospecimen processing?
Oh, sorry. Yeah, that was just kind of the same thing. They'll process your sample for you. Sorry. I kind of go off the cuff on slides a little bit, everybody.
So that's saliva and blood, correct?
Oh, I'm sorry. Yes, we can do saliva and blood as well. That's in a different, I was in tissue bank mode. But we do also have a biospecimen repository, which can be confusing to people when you hear, you know, tissue bank. It sounds like biospecimen, but actually they're not interchangeable terms with us. The biospecimen repository is actually more for blood and spit, things like that. And that is located in the cancer center. But if you need serum samples or blood spin downs, you know, samples aliquoted, things like that, we can handle those for you as well. Sorry, good catch, Megan.
Got your back.
Okay. So now we get into the CRDEB core, as we call it, the Clinical Research Design, Epidemiology, and Biostatistics core. So that is where 90% of my work happens. So in that core, we offer many different services for investigators, such as PhD level statistical experts to consult, help you do, you know, sample size calculations, effect size calculations, things like that. They can also do all of your data analysis, data management. They'll help you with your study design, spatial analysis, which we're going to talk a little bit more about here in another slide, but we do offer that as well. And they can help you with your method sections for your manuscripts, presentations, things like that.
Hey, Wes, there was a question in the chat box from Dr. Naeem.
I'm sorry. Let me look. Cardiovascular disease? Is that what you mean by CVD?
Yes, Wes. So, I mean, any frozen CVD, I mean, like particularly coronary artery disease samples, I mean, patient samples are frozen, are they?
I would say, you know, I don't want to tell you for 100% sure, but I would say with high likelihood we do have some, but I can look for you. And okay. We keep them frozen at negative 80, so, you know, they last quite a while. And, you know, depending on the analysis, you know, if you wanted to do RNA or something like that, we do have specific preservation methods that we add so that those samples can be stored for a long period of time. But let me look into that after this, and I can send you an email to let you know.
No, Wes, I am looking for phospholipids in this, the oxylipins profile in these samples. If it is available, that will be a great thing for me.
Okay. Yeah, I will look into that for you. I will let you know in a separate email after the presentation.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you, Wes.
Absolutely. Okay. So now back to the, you know, we sort of touched on the spatial modeling. So we do have a PhD level spatial biostatistician who is absolutely wonderful in our core. So we offer a lot of spatial modeling services through him and some of his graduate students. So we can actually, you know, we look at clustering of diseases, create heat maps. You know, a recent example is modeling spatial variation and community level risk of fatal or non-fatal overdose and geographic access to prevention and treatment services. Another one we're currently looking at is congestive heart failure in relation to patient proximity to active and non-active coal mines. We also can look at things such as outcomes for patients with heart failure in relation to distance to center for, you know, a tier one hospital to see if the outcomes are different. We've also done some work looking at cancer clusterings in relation to fracking sites, active, non-active coal mines, you know, many different things like that. So we can use zip codes. That's pretty common to use zip code level data. But we can actually really even drill down much further than that. And we can look at either, you know, like I said, we can look at zip codes. We can look at RUC codes, which is something that is basically assigned. It basically determines the rurality of an area. Or we can even go all the way down into census tracts for those locations to really drill down where we think issues are happening. So we do quite a bit of work with spatial modeling and analysis. And that's, you know, it's becoming much more and more popular, and we receive many more requests than we normally do. Constance asked, aren't those PHI? Absolutely, they are PHI. So in order for us to do those analysis, obviously you've got to have an approved IRB that includes all of those types of things, a HIPAA waiver of consent if you're using retrospective data for PHI. So yes, that's a good question, and they are PHI. Next slide, Megan. Okay, so this is where most of my work and also Emily's work happen. The Integrated Data Repository, or the IDR, you've probably heard that term. And what the IDR is, it is a real-time copy of all of WVU Medicine electronic patient health records. That is not just Ruby Memorial, that is every hospital in the WVU Medicine healthcare system, which I think is up to 11 now. As long as the site is on Epic, we have access to all that patient data. So we create custom data sets for folks looking for research. So, you know, an example, someone would come to me or Emily and they would say, hey, we're interested in, well, this is a hot topic. We want to look at patients who are COVID positive. We want to know the race of those patients. We want to know the age. We want to know any pre-existing diagnoses, any labs that they had, were they admitted into the hospital, what procedures did they have, what medications were they given. So we would pull all of those data in a large data set and provide it in a CSV file. We can get very granular in the data we present. As a matter of fact, we pulled a lot of data for an FDA convalescent plasma therapy trial. And we were actually, for the patients who are admitted with COVID receiving the therapy, we could even pull the ventilator settings every 10 minutes. If somebody changed a ventilator setting, we would pull that. We would pull their blood gas oxygenation every couple minutes. You know, we can look at your O2 every 10 seconds. So we can get very, very granular with these kinds of data. So some of the highlights of that is some of the geocoding and addresses for geospatial analysis that we just sort of talked about. You know, we have an extremely secure method of handling these data. Anybody that has worked with me or the CTSI is very aware, you know, we take the security of these data very seriously. We do not provide anything to you that has not been approved per the IRB. Even if the IRB has approved it, in some instances, we even go above and beyond that, depending on the cohort of patients you're looking for. If they are sort of a protected groups, you know, with infectious diseases, children, mental health diagnosis, we may even make you go a step further and get a obtain a certificate of confidentiality from the NIH prior to us delivering that data to you, because that would prohibit any you know, court order to turn over that data in the event that something were to happen, because we do not want any of those patients' data to get out there. We also have decedent data incorporated into the IDR. So we have National Death Index data up until, I want to say, 2018. And the reason we stopped there is because it cost about $400,000 for 5 years of data. And for our population, it really wasn't that big of a value add, because obviously most of the WVU medicine patients do tend to be from West Virginia. So we just weren't seeing an enormous amount of, you know, out-of-state folks that were dying outside of West Virginia, you know, to sort of make sense for us to spend another $450,000 on that. We have the DHHR vital statistics data, and we also have access to the medical examiner data. So that's something that sometimes folks come to us for, especially when you're looking at overdoses and things like that, where we can actually pull autopsy reports to find out for these patients, you know, what was really the cause of death, what was the toxicology findings and things like that. The IDR also has many different patient research registries that are constantly updated. We have a heart failure registry of all patients that were diagnosed with heart failure in the WVU medicine system for all time. I think we've got about 30,000 patients in there, and we've got about 10 million data points. So we are constantly, you know, sort of updating that, and it's a very robust, you know, registry for folks. And the biggest registry happening right now, I hope it's on the next slide. I might have messed up. Oh, I nailed it. Yeah. So it's the COVID-19 registry. So we're pretty savvy with building these kinds of registries for folks. So when COVID happened, before West Virginia even had its first case, I sort of talked to my team, and I talked to my software architect, and I said, you know, we got to pull this thing together. Let's go ahead and start the infrastructure, because, you know, COVID's coming. We know it's coming. It's going to be a super hot topic, and it's going to be the center of research, data-related research, for years to come. So let's get on this. So we did. So we built the registry. So any patient that's come through WVU medicine that's tested positive, well, not just positive, that's tested for COVID. We've got about 19,000 negatives right now, and about 2,000 positives, somewhere like that, 1,500, 2,000. We have all the pre-existing diagnoses, basically anything that was ever in the medical record about these people for the COVID, we've got it. And actually it was really interesting because of the COVID registry we built, it kind of got a national attention. And then the NIH kind of found out. Our director, Dr. Hodder, reached out to the NIH, and they said, hey, we want you guys to lead a national NIH COVID registry, which we were funded by the NIH to do so. And there's going to be about 30 sites worth of data in the registry for folks to access. It's going to be in a data enclave, and you can do statistical analysis. So it's going to be really, really cool. And that just went live yesterday it went live. And we expect that in about a month that researchers are going to have access to that. So it's going to be really neat. And it is a limited data set. So there are zip codes and dates in there, because obviously zip codes are important, and dates are very important if you're going to look at things like, you know, readmissions. You want to look at outcomes such as ICU length of stay or hospitalization, things like that. So, you know, we have, like I said, we kind of have just about everything in the medical record in the registry, but once in a while we are approached by an investigator and they have like a really wonky request or really a niche type of request that we didn't think to pull in there. And in that case, we just go ahead and pull the data in there so that we have it moving forward. Okay, Megan, next slide. All right, so I will turn it over to Emily. Did anybody have any questions about any of those slides? I know I kind of rambled through them really quickly. All right, Emily, I think you can take it away.
All right, thank you. So I'd like to highlight just a couple of specialized platforms that CTSI facilitates access to for researchers that are really useful for all kinds of clinical research. So I'll start with Trinetics, which is a global health research network. And essentially for us, Trinetics acts as a de-identified front end to the Epic medical system. If you're familiar with Slicer-Dicer, it is similar in nature to Slicer-Dicer, but I think it has some important advantages over Slicer-Dicer. So it was originally created as a way to connect healthcare organizations, biopharmaceutical companies, and contract research organizations to improve enrollment in clinical trials, particularly for rare diseases or in specialized populations, to expedite bringing new therapies to market. And to add a benefit to healthcare organizations to make them want to join the platform, they have offered them their data back and provided a lot of analysis and exploration tools to go along with it. So for members at West Virginia University, you have access to run queries across fully de-identified data from WVU Medicine, which is about 1.4 million patients. And again, that is all 11 or so hospitals in the network. Or alternatively, we also have access to the Research Network, which is a fully anonymous group of healthcare organizations who have come together and decided to pool their patient populations to provide researchers access to a greater extent of patients. So, you know, West Virginia is a smaller state. If you're looking at something rare or specialized, you may not find the patient population you're looking for here. So then you would be able to come and look at the Research Network, which is growing all the time. So WVU was a founding member back in May 2017. There were only 16 healthcare organizations. I believe now they're up to 41. And I feel like every time I talk about Trinetics, that number goes up again. So again, constantly growing, more and more patients available. So when you have your cohort of patients, if you go back really quick. So once you have your cohort put together, there are some exploration tools you can use. So you can look at comorbidities, common procedures, medications, and labs across your patient population. You can look at rate of arrival if you're interested in potentially recruiting for a prospective clinical trial. Trinetics has some tools that give you an idea of what kind of enrollment you might expect to see. And also, I don't have it mentioned on the slide, but actually Trinetics will approach us occasionally with clinical trials. So Shelley Welch, who is the co-director of our Clinical Trial Center of Excellence, will occasionally reach out to researchers if we receive a trial request that seems in line with someone's research interests. So there's also an analytics feature, which I will talk about more in a bit. But before I get into analytics, just briefly, I want to mention that we can re-identify WVU Medicine data. So as you're playing around in Trinetics, you don't need an IRB for any of that, which I think is an improvement over Slicer-Dicer. You can never accidentally see information you are not supposed to see. And if you're looking at WVU Medicine Network, you can, with IRB approval, we have the linkage to turn Trinetics de-identified IDs back into MRNs. And we can provide further custom data sets from there if there's something that you need that you're not finding in Trinetics, such as if it's really important to you to have the MRN or to have PHI such as zip codes, we can do that for you. I just want to highlight a couple upcoming enhancements as well. And this is a very small selection because Trinetics is constantly growing and improving. But we're hoping to add on the Diamond Network, which is patient linking to a third-party payer and claims data set, as well as pharmaceutical data. So expanding the portrait of a patient beyond just what happens to them at WVU Medicine, but then if they have a primary care physician who's not part of WVU, if they fill their prescriptions at a pharmacy outside the WVU Medicine network, you have more information about really the whole spectrum of a patient's medical record. And then also, we're very excited for natural language processing. So Trinetics partners with a company to extract discrete information from free text notes. So for example, if something that we've run into before with cardiovascular disease is that ejection fraction percentage is not currently a discrete field in Epic, so it would only be contained in free text notes. But ejection fraction is an important criteria for inclusion or exclusion criteria in a study. So we would be able to turn these notes over to Trinetics, and then they would be able to pull out a specific number or a specific range from that free text. And then finally, I think one of the best features of Trinetics right now is the analytics feature. And again, this is built in. This doesn't require any kind of specialized biostatistical knowledge. They've really made everything about Trinetics user-friendly, from your cohort creation to running these analyses. So once you have your cohort, or cohorts plural, created in Trinetics, you can actually run a variety of analyses on them directly within the platform. And so I have an example here of a Kaplan-Meier survival analysis from one of the sample studies I've run. So if you've ever happened to attend a Trinetics training session with me, or a demo, or if you've seen the YouTube tutorial that I have up on the CTSI YouTube page, this comes directly from one of the sample queries I run there. So you have the option to analyze outcomes over time for a single cohort. You can compare cohorts on outcomes via measures of association, Kaplan-Meier survival analysis. Since they've added in treatment pathways, so you can look at the kinds of treatments that are given to a specific cohort and also the specific order in which those treatments are usually tried. And one of the best features is that you can actually balance your cohorts with built-in propensity score matching. So as you're as you're setting up your analysis, Trinetics has an option to flag for you areas in which your two cohorts are significantly different that could impact the final outcome of your analysis. And balancing your cohort around those factors is as easy as clicking one button to say, yes, this is a factor I want to balance on. And then you hit run and Trinetics does the math for you. And it throughout the platform, there's nice graphics that you can export. You can export additional data. So they make it really easy for you to kind of run a research project from start to finish in a short length of time and have all the tools right there for you. So the other, switching gears a little bit, the other specialized platform I wanted to talk about is REDCap, which I think some of you are already familiar with and have used. So REDCap stands for Research Electronic Data Capture, and it is a secure and web-based application for data capture and storage. So this lives on our servers. We have a full-time REDCap administrator who oversees security issues, data quality issues, and also provides support in terms of if assisting you in building a REDCap project, or if you have that, if you have funding, or if you have a high priority project assisting you with the builds themselves. So within REDCap, you can build and send surveys to participants, or you can enter data directly into a database. So it has a very user-friendly interface to do a variety of very complicated things. So you can actually have built-in randomization to a particular treatment in REDCap. You can do longitudinal entries, so recurring records on the same participant over time. You can have anonymization, and all of that is built right into the user interface. There's a lot of data quality and protection measures. So there's some specific steps you'll take, but then it ensures that you can never accidentally overwrite a variable or change the coding of a variable so that you're switching yes and no. And also audit trails. So if you're looking to run a clinical trial, you can see every edit that has been made by anyone with access to a given project. So you can see, you know, if records are deleted, who did that, if records have been changed, who did that and when. And we also do keep backups just in case someone deletes something they shouldn't, we can assist you in recovering that data. Once you have your data in there, whether you've entered it yourself or collected it from participants, you can then download it back out, and REDCap does a good job of formatting it if you're using R, Stata, SPSS, SAS, Excel, any of the major statistical analysis platforms. REDCap has it formatted correctly. And so lastly, I just want to highlight how you can get to all of these services, which is the iLab platform. So any, just about any service you request from CTSI is going to come through iLab. So that includes everything we've talked here today. If you're interested in funding opportunities, COE assistance, REDCap, Trinetics, data sets, biostatistical consultations, even tissue requests, all of that will come into iLab in one way or another. So iLab is a really cool platform. It has essentially you'll just find the correct core. And a lot of them are pretty self-explanatory. So for example, biospecimen processing core, our clinical research design, epidemiology and biostatistics core, investigator development. And then there's usually a form that we'll ask you to fill out that covers some information about your project. And that form will differ from service to service depending on what information we need to collect from you. So for example, if you're submitting a data request through iLab, we'll collect your IRB approval if you have it and your variables that you want to request from us, any inclusion-exclusion criteria, et cetera. So it's, I would say, somewhat user-friendly. Once you have run through it the first time and you know where you need to click, then it gets a lot easier to use. But the advantage of iLab is we're able to store everything in one central place, so we can keep record of compliance documentation, of our staff members who actually pull the data or run these consultations, keep track of their time. We keep track of the quantity and variety of services we provide, and then we can easily export that out from iLab to report back to our funding agency, NIH and NIGMS. And so by promptly and accurately filling stuff out in iLab helps us report back to our funding agency, makes us look good, and then they keep funding us, and then we're able to continue to offer these to you for free or for very low cost. So it's in everybody's advantage to keep track of stuff as accurately as possible. And so I can cover the membership as well. So I see a question in the chat is, how do we get to iLab? I can send you that link afterward, or you can find a link to iLab on the CTSI website, which is just wvctsi.org is probably the quickest way to get there. So the other thing I want to highlight is that we do require that anyone receiving services from us joins us as a WVCTSI member, which comes with the benefits of access to training and mentoring opportunities, all of the services that we've outlined here in this presentation today, joining our listserv so you're aware of when funding opportunities are released and any kind of deadlines for those projects. We also highlight researchers who have worked with the CTSI and are achieving great results, and other opportunities that are of interest to clinical and translational researchers. So membership is a requirement for all of these things, and it gets you a lot of benefits in return. I highlight that membership is a different process from iLab, so it can get a little bit confusing, but the membership form is pretty quick. We just ask you to fill out, you know, your name, your departmental affiliation, some information about your research. You can upload a CV if you like, and then after about just the 5-minute form process, then you're officially a member. And again, the membership is free. So you don't need to pay us anything. As soon as you fill out that form, you are good to go. And both the membership form and the iLab, as well as some more comprehensive information about our services and where you would go to find each type of service, are available from our website. All right, any questions on that last section of the presentation, or any questions for Wes or Megan?
Cool question, Megan.
Yeah.
How you doing? Thanks, that was a good presentation. Emily, Wes, appreciate it. Let's say I'm working with PIs and we wanna de-risk their IP for licensing opportunities. And can you provide the PIs with like strategic pathways on how to move forward in regards to like in vivo testing, you know, what sort of in vivo testing needs to be done on like therapeutics, or what sort of clinical testing needs to be done for like implants into the body for a IDE?
Sure. So, Lester, Emily, feel free to jump in as well. I would say probably for the clinical or the human subjects, we would be more ready to help with that, those questions. If it's more on animal studies or something like that, we've got a number of people on our team or affiliates that we could contact, but we would probably be better suited to help with when it's ready for human subjects or getting ready some of those preclinical studies. But Dr. Hodder has, you know, a wealth of experience with clinical trials and can advise on that. And we've got other people on our team. Some of our co-directors of our PI Academy, Dr. Goldberg, who was the Cancer Center Director, and Dr. Reed, who's in the School of Pharmacy, can also advise on that. And so if it's something really specific to a new drug or a new device development, it might be an opportunity to present at our PI Academy Idea Lab. And so if somebody's interested in that, we have like sort of a short slide template where we can get some background information, we collect that, and then they can present on what they're hoping to find out, talk about, you know, how many participants they would want to recruit. So there's biostats people that we can include in the conversation, and then people who have conducted a lot of clinical trials over the years. So does that kind of answer your question?
Yeah, no, it does. It's great. So what do I tell these guys? Like, should I tell them to sign up on iLabs or submit the request on iLabs, or should they email you, or?
They can email me, and depending on what it is, you know, I can direct them to the right iLab form to fill out. There's not an iLab form right now to present to the Idea Lab, and I don't think we'll move to that. It's just a first come, first serve basis. So we would have the November session free. We've got somebody lined up for October. But if somebody's got an idea, they can certainly present in November, or we can set up sort of an ad hoc meeting impromptu and discuss what their goals are, what funding they have, targeted funding opportunities, and sort of set them up to be competitive.
All right. Yeah, no, that sounds good. Thank you. I appreciate it.
Are there any other questions? All right. Well, thank you guys very much for this presentation, and everyone on the call. We do have this presentation deck that can be emailed out to you guys for reference and available for anyone that missed this recording. And again, this will be recorded and available on the Tech Transfer site shortly. But thanks, Emily, Megan, and Wes. I really appreciate it.
Thanks, Jim.
Thank you.
Thank you.